Welcome to Bruin One Ear and Out the Other. Our guest on today's podcast is Gary Nell, Chairman of National Geographic. We had the opportunity to speak with Gary on May 1st. We talked about his time at UCLA, including interviewing Joe Biden at Ackerman Union for the Daily Bruin, presiding as CEO of Sesame Workshop during the infamous Katy Perry incident, bridging the partisan divide at NPR as its CEO, and his current chairman of the board position at National Geographic. So without further ado, here is our interview with Gary. Hi, Gary. Thank you for joining us on Bruin One Ear and Out the Other.
Great to be here, Pranav. Thanks for having me.
Because this is a UCLA-themed podcast, one of the things we wanted to do was ask one of the questions that current applicants have to answer as part of the application. We think it will serve as a great introduction for our listeners. So the prompt is, describe the most significant challenge you have faced and the steps you have taken to overcome this challenge.
Well, we're certainly in a huge challenge today with COVID, which I'm sure everyone listening would also relate to, and figuring out what to concentrate on, what to really prioritize. How do you, as a leader, take care of the people who work for the organization and then continue to pump out amazing content is a real challenge with no rule book. So I think that's been a huge challenge. But I've spent most of my career really focusing on disruption and disrupting companies for performance to try to get them, especially mission-driven media companies who are legacies. And I've somehow found myself in the position of trying to rework them for a bigger impact. And each of them have had fascinating challenges, and each of them are unique in their own way, that you've had to get your head around and try to repurpose.
So let's go to the first media company you worked for. It's not going to be one maybe that you might expect, but it was the Daily Bruin, and you were editorial editor there. How was that experience? How do you think that shaped your career?
Well, that's the only one I can tell you I did not disrupt enough. So I loved working at the Daily Bruin, and in fact, I just got honored this year by the Daily Bruin as an alumni, which was really, really wonderful, and got to see some of my former colleagues from the days at the Bruin, and we went back and looked at some of the outrageous things we put on the cover of that newspaper, which even shocked me. It was a tremendous learning experience, and I joke that I don't remember any classes at UCLA. I only remember working on the newspaper. We were publishing a 30,000 circulation daily newspaper with advertising and an art section with state-of-the-art content, sports, where we had won all the NCAA championships during the glory years of John Wooden's basketball era. The football program was robust, and it was just a center of the universe for a lot of us during a tumultuous time in our country. Vietnam was still raging, and it was Watergate. So we lived through a lot of things in that era when I was on campus. And the Bruin was the center of the town square, so to speak. So it was a wonderful place to be. And I cut my teeth there. And I am grateful forever that I was in the middle of it.
Do you remember any of the, I know you mentioned some of those headlines you were surprised that you ran. Do you remember what some of them were, or some of the topics maybe that you probably wouldn't publish today?
Well, I mean, I did some investigative pieces that my colleagues today would probably be shocked at, but we did some investigative takedowns of things in the medical school. We were involved with, tuition increases in the University of California. At that moment in time, there was a big push to get a student onto the UC Board of Regents. and we really pressed that agenda. It was all, and as editorial director, I was head of the editorial page, which became quite a hard-fought page for column inches, as we would call it, that you would try to get your, you know, your point of view on there and getting some sort of balance. And at the time, it was the end of the Shah of Iran's regime in Iran. And there were a lot of Iranian students at UCLA that were against the Shah and for the revolution. And they were very well organized. And they had a sit-in in my office and kind of held us to make sure that their points were in the paper. It wasn't, I don't want to be too dramatic about it. It wasn't that terrible, but it was an interesting time. There were just a lot of global issues that came to campus, and we were in the middle of a lot of them.
That's really fascinating. Did that kind of seep into your classes then as a poli-sci major?
Oh, for sure. You know, there were a few classes that I particularly really connected to. One on American politics, which was taught by a guy named Paul Halpern, and he brought these incredible people like the late David Halberstam to campus, who was one of the best American historians. He wrote a book called The Best and the Brightest about the Kennedy administration, and another one about the Japanese auto industry. He died tragically in an auto accident a couple decades ago, but he brought people like that to campus, and it was a way of, you know, speaking in front of groups of students who at that time were very politically motivated, and being able to bring being at UCLA was a special place. And you know, I remember actually freshman Senator Joe Biden coming to Ackerman Union to give a talk, and I believe he was elected to the Senate at age 34, or age 29 rather, and you have to be 30 to be a U.S. Senator. And he wasn't going to become, he would turn 30 before he was sworn in. So he was that young, and I believe he was 31 or 32 years old when he came to Ackerman, and I remember interviewing him for the paper, along with lots of other people like Ralph Nader and, you know, Jerry Brown and lots of other people who were young and in the beginnings or prime of their political career. So it was quite a time.
So would you say then that you were thinking potentially a career in journalism? It sounds like you both editorial, you worked on that and you got to do some key interviews. And yeah. I think we read that you were even a stringer for the AP back in the day.
Yeah, and I was. And yes, I was pretty intent on getting into journalism. I did it in high school and college. And UCLA, when I entered as a freshman, actually had a journalism major and they had journalism courses. And then they decided, of course, after the first year I was there, to shut down the major, because they thought it was too much of a trade and not enough of a profession, interestingly enough, looking back. There were some wonderful journalism professors there, though, who had big influences on me. And I was able to take courses in magazine writing, photojournalism, arts criticism by the head arts critic of the LA Times, and just, you know, those sorts of things that really improved my ability to write and take some pretty, you know, harsh criticism at times, which I can still remember to this day. And as my staff knows, I annoyed them terribly by copy editing a lot of work today. And the editor-in-chief of National Geographic, Susan Goldberg, a wonderful colleague, is constantly annoyed with my suggestions. So it... that maybe it's revenge, I guess, I've had after many decades of studying journalism.
So after UCLA, you go to Loyola Law School. What was that experience for you? Did you know what type of law you wanted to practice? Where were you headed?
Well, I'd really gotten the political bug at UCLA, and I entered as very interested in sports journalism, and I'm still a big sports fan. But I but I became more of a political writer, and I really, I just enjoyed the world of politics, and I'm a bit of a political junkie today still. I read Politico every morning. I wanted to get into the law really for public policy. I had interned with Callan with UCLA in Sacramento, and had worked up there for the Assembly Majority Leader and then the governor's office at the time. And so it was really to get into legislation, and that's really what I did. I never really practiced law to, you know, as you would not normally think of it. I went to work immediately after law school on Capitol Hill in Washington as a young counsel for a couple Senate committees. And it was wonderful training for that.
So how did you end up going from working in the Senate Judiciary and Governmental Affairs Committees in DC to a career in media companies? How did that transition kind of happen?
Well, you know, this is where the growing up in LA and being part of the media and the movie industry and everything else that you're kind of surrounded by your friends' parents and everything else. And UCLA comes together with Capitol Hill, and you go like, wow, I could be like in really involved in the media, and I love the policy side. So I really went to work doing government relations for WNET in New York, which was the largest public television station in the country and launched a lot of big shows. This is, of course, before cable even really took off. So we had the big shows in natural history and performance programming, in theatrical pieces that were really huge back in the day, sort of before Downton Abbey. There was a show called Brideshead Revisited, which was huge. And the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and Robin McNeil and all kinds of other things were birthed out of there. So it was a wonderful place. And I was involved with getting public funding in Albany and in Washington, and representing the station on lots of committees and working on FCC matters. So I was able to use kind of a regulatory framework to use my background, and also the appreciation of journalism let me relate well to the production staff, because I was pretty familiar with what went into productions in general.
So then at Sesame Workshop, you started corporate affairs, moved your way up to CEO for about 11 years. Tell us about that experience. What were your kind of key initiatives there, and what was Sesame Workshop around 2000, and where did you leave it?
Still going. So, you know, despite my best efforts, I didn't totally wreck it. It's 50 years on now, and it's an amazing franchise to this day. And I'm so proud of my successors of what they've done, because I don't know about you, but it is like everywhere now. So in fact, for those folks listening, Pranav has a background on his Zoom call of the Sesame Street set, just to show you how prevalent they are everywhere. So Sesame Street, in a nutshell, is everything everyone knows about it, a magical platform for children, but also for grownups to connect using the power of these incredible Muppet characters who are enveloped in current culture to promote educational outcomes, especially for kids in under-resourced areas. That's what it was birthed about in the late 60s by Joan Ganz Cooney and Lloyd Morissette, and it stayed true to its word for 50 years. And I can't think of anything else that's quite done that. You know, it's outlived pretty much everything. It's won more Emmys than any show in television history. It's a remarkable place. But on the business side, what made it so great to really learn from and then lead was that it's had an entrepreneurial way of never being really dependent on public funding, that it was a government funding. So it was able to, that's why you had the Tickle Me Elmos and all of these other toys, which your audience probably annoyed their parents to buy them when they were little kids. And those revenues were able to pay for really the content that got created. It was a licensing model that we could use for a public good. And that was a really, really revolutionary idea, I think, when Joan and others created it in the 1970s, and we carried it on, at least I jumped into it in the 90s, and then, you know, kept at it in the 2000s. And I think they still go at it today by doing some of these joint partnerships with Apple and other people that you see on television.
So Sesame Street was a nonprofit, and can you talk a little bit about the importance for it to be set up as one? And you referenced Tickle Me Elmo. Not a lot of people know that a nonprofit can kind of have these verticals where they're selling it and making profit, but as long as they kind of bring it back into the business, it can still be categorized as a nonprofit.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways, it's, you know, when you think of it, you think of the UCLA football program or basketball program. You know, with the football program probably, which make revenues for the university, and by selling T-shirts and, you know, memorabilia and all kinds of other things that relate that people wear, and the sweatshirts in Ackerman Union that you buy in the UCLA store, those royalties come to the university, which then pay for expenses or offset tuition or whatever they are used for. And it's really the same concept. So the concept is taking the intellectual property of Sesame Street or National Geographic and licensing them to people in the field. And in Sesame's case, it was big deals with people like Mattel or Hasbro and Sony and other people who Random House and books. So they could publish books, and then Sesame would be able to reap the profits to then get plowed into continuing the educational work that they do. It's not an uncommon practice, but it's a very unique practice to do well. So to get it right, and it takes a lot of work and really talented people who understand the brand inside and out.
You kind of talked a little bit about the mission of Sesame Street. Wanted to know your thoughts on if you think it's how it's helped to improve childhood learning, and what is the importance of having adult celebrities come on and help promote the show?
Yeah, so Sesame Street is the most researched television program, I can assure you, in history. There's been more master's thesis and probably doctoral dissertations done about a longitudinal look at Sesame Street's effectiveness in driving educational outcomes than any other television platform, for sure. They could probably fill a half a library themselves. The whole point of the celebrity additions to the show, and there's so many great ones. My favorite happens to be one with Ricky Gervais and Elmo, which everyone should go on YouTube and watch. It's probably Ricky Gervais was the only person to ever do a proper takedown of Elmo and get away with it. It was just fantastic. But there's so many great, great pieces. And I was just telling one of my colleagues who's gone back to HBO and watched 6 Feet Under, this show that was on, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, that, we had the count doing, 1 feet under, 2 feet under, 3, 4. So you could use all of these things for the lessons. And that was the whole point. It was actually designed as dual viewing. Now, you got to go back to the 1970s when you didn't have all these options of cable or certainly the internet. So parents would sit with their child and watch the show together originally and reinforce the messages from the show. And the kids may not know who Alicia Keys is, but the parents know who she is. And they're so stoked that Alicia Keys is doing some funny gig on the thing, or that they enjoy it just seeing how cool it is. And the kids are just enjoying the fun. So it's a coolness factor, and it's a relevancy factor. We always used to say, in order to teach kids, you got to reach kids, and it's really about engaging and entertaining them. And if you think about the teachers who are most effective in the classroom, they don't necessarily have to be comedians, but they do have to reach their students. And you know exactly who I'm talking about in your personal experiences. You can name probably the best teachers you've ever had, and you can probably name the worst teachers you ever had, because and the rest of them are a big blur in the middle that you can't very well remember. But because they're the people who are the most engaging and really, really impact you. And then there's those that are so bad that somehow they stand out in a sea of names.
A side note right there, was there anything like brunewalk.com? There probably was an internet back then, but a professor reviewing system of some sort back then?
Yeah, they did. Well, there was no internet. So I know it's hard to believe for anybody, but yes, there was no internet. So there were kind of secret ratings, and there was a place called Cliff Notes, and there was actually a store in Westwood where you would go and buy the lecture notes that somebody would sort of take very secretly and post them so you could avoid going to class. That was before there was the web, but this whole explosion, which my kids went through, of, you know, being able to rate your professors is probably one of the most frightening things to ever hit academics. But it's also a great leveling and a great honesty of getting your act together if you're a professor.
So speaking of, you mentioned bringing some of those celebrities into the show, and Sesame Street wasn't without a couple minor controversies, one of which that comes to mind is the Katy Perry episode where I think she sang a duet with Elmo that didn't end up getting broadcast. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that experience and what you remember.
Well, of course, that is quite mild by today's standards, I suppose, is Katy Perry apparently was on Idol this week wearing a Clorox bottle or something. But so she hasn't really changed. She came on the set wearing, a rather skimpy outfit, I guess. So, and I think some of our communications people thought it was going to be a bit troublesome for some of the viewers in her skit. It was a bit of a suggestive performance. So what we ended up doing was and this was a stroke of genius that I had nothing to do with, but the idea was that we would release sort of a clean version on television and release the full version on the web. And of course, the full version went crazy. And I will look at some point what the number of hits, they were in the tens of millions. And it must be over 100 million views of that thing by now. And then she was on Saturday Night Live. You can go back and watch this the following Saturday wearing a Elmo t-shirt that was well fitted, let's just say that. So she got what she wanted, which was kind of this bad girl, you know, kind of image, but all American at the same time. And we got what we wanted, which was this very hipness thing. And the thing just blew up and became a huge success for everybody. So it was quite a interesting thing to look back on.
So another kind of thing that you were implemental or crucial for at Sesame Street was kind of leading co-productions in South Africa, India, and North Ireland. Kind of, we've talked about Sesame Street as a universal language for storytelling, but I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on hyper-localization of content and kind of, there's specific Muppets that you were helpful in creating for specific countries for specific social impact missions.
Yeah, so we thought about the power of Sesame Street to really be locally adapted as an indigenous way to promote educational outcomes around curricula that was important and locally relevant. So the one thing we did not want to be is just one show out of America that sort of plays like peanut butter everywhere, that there are a lot of shows that do that. The Simpsons is one, and you know, you're not going to localize The Simpsons. Oh, maybe you could, but The Simpsons represents this view of America to the world that is incredibly popular, you know? So, and there are other shows that do that. But with Sesame Street, I think the point was, we're going to do a show for India. Let's do a show, or South Africa. Let's do a show that actually speaks to the needs of the country. And we are not the ones from New York to decide what is best for India or South Africa or Jordan, but they should really decide on their own. So we actually got together academics and other early childhood curriculum experts in those countries and held content seminars to decide what they would put on a preschool show like Sesame Street. And we were able to create those. And I'm really proud of the work that we did in South Africa, especially with Takalani Sesame, which still airs to this day, 20 years later. And, you know, it was revolutionary at the time. We created an HIV positive Muppet character named Cammy, because at the time, 1 in 9 kids were HIV positive, if you can imagine. And there was a lot of reactionary public policies in that country at the time, which were really harming children, and they were being discriminated against in a pretty harsh way. And we were able to create empathy for those kids, and it made a huge difference in the culture there. That's just one of many examples, I think, where the power of the brand was able to penetrate a culture.
So it wasn't just in these foreign countries that you took on kind of a social stance. I remember that, I think this was in the maybe early 2000s, for Cookie Monster, you ended up making him eat less cookies and introduce fruits and vegetables and tried to rehab his image a little bit to make him more health conscious. Maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of the, not just the international reach, but some of those social important issues in the United States.
Sure, and not only that, but I brought Cookie Monster to the UCLA commencement in 2005, where I was a commencement speaker, and I had Cookie Monster with me in Pauley Pavilion, which was fantastic because he was able to do a whole thing about eating healthy food, and of course the students weren't having it. And I made him eat a Brussels sprout, and he spit it out into the audience. So it was a classic moment. I guarantee you, anyone in the class of 2005 will not remember who spoke to them, but they will always remember Cookie Monster. So, but I think the point on this one, Nakin, was to have this character, and even a glutton like Cookie Monster, could learn, and kids would learn that, you know, it's okay to have a cookie, but in moderation. You know, it's all about self-control, and Cookie Monster's whole thing is about self-control, and he's so silly because he has no self-control, right? And I think the message there was really about, look, even there's a mom with a child in Baltimore who can have a conversation, say, look, you know, even Cookie Monster can't eat cookies all the time, right? And I think that's the point of this. It wasn't turning him into the veggie monster, but it was sort of the kind of controversy that we loved. That's exactly, the more it was talked about, the better. And I even got a bunch of US senators involved in this thing, including Hillary Clinton, who was a US senator at the time, and Jeff Sessions, and all kinds of people who probably regret having cut these PSAs now looking back, but they're probably pretty hilarious to go take a look at again 15 years later.
So after Sesame Street, you go to NPR, you're CEO there. You're described as a calming presence who made progress on both sides of the political aisle at NPR. How did you do that? What was the importance of that? And maybe since you had experience interviewing Joe Biden and other political figures back at UCLA, did that seep into NPR?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I went to NPR. I could have stayed at Sesame, but I felt I had a kind of a calling back to Washington. to help NPR, which was in a pretty bad place politically. There'd been a couple scandals they were wrapped up in. They were kind of getting hammered by a lot of polarized media. And I felt like they were somewhat misunderstood because the public radio system is really, you know, 300 stations and represent blue and red districts all over the place. And people think of Wyoming Public Radio, which provides a tremendous service to the state of Wyoming, as an example. So it was a way of going in and trying to re-educate members of Congress. And I've had a lot of experience on the Hill working on education in my past life as a staff member. But it was more just a believer in what public radio stood for, which was education. And it was educating grown-ups about culture or foreign affairs or health care issues or what have you. And I really tried to promote a diversity agenda at NPR, which focused on ethnic and racial diversity, geographic diversity, and political diversity, that you would not just have a monotony of the same voices, which we see way too much in the media today. And we all go to our echo chambers to hear what we want to hear. And the other echo chamber is so nauseating to the other side that it's almost impossible to listen to. The fact is, most people would like to have a common town hall where they could actually have civic discussions around these issues. And that was really what NPR should be and what we tried to promote.
And so you took over kind of in this tumultuous time that you're talking about. Your predecessor resigned under pressure after a fundraiser was happening where I believe they called the Tea Party racist. And so this kind of started a fight where conservatives wanted to pull some of the funding. And so I think it's important for maybe some of our viewers to kind of get the idea that this politicization has kind of happened and existed for quite some time, and it's not really a new idea.
You know, exactly. Look, I think public broadcasting actually, I mean, all kidding aside, you know, has been a sort of controversy by certain factions for a long time. And in fact, Newt Gingrich, when the House flipped over in 1994, and he had something called a contract for America, and among it was defunding public broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, all these kinds of programs. And I think the issue was really that their view was that these programs really shouldn't be supported by taxpayers. They ought to be, you know, privately funded. There's enough philanthropy out there. But, you know, a lot of it comes down to a similar view of public, in my opinion, public education, and why the University of California is partially publicly funded. It's not completely publicly funded. Any of you know as students that God knows you're paying tuition and enough tuition and room and board, and UCLA has to have a robust development effort to raise lots of money for the university to meet its payroll and to meet its capital costs and everything else. So it's a public-private partnership, and I think that's what public broadcasting. But all these things have been quite controversial over the years, and it's a view of society. It comes down to kind of a view of society of what is the role of public institutions versus private institutions. And I still think we're having that sorted out as we speak. You know, we're viewing our society today during COVID as being very divided, and you're beginning to see disruption, I think, in social disruption, because people, Americans, have a unique view of public, you know, private, quote unquote, freedom versus public considerations for the greater good. And where that balance is really the underlying issue behind all of these kinds of debates that go on, and public broadcasting is no different.
So walk us through a little bit some of the business challenges that you encountered at NPR. What were some of the kind of issues that needed to work on? And I know, I think this is right, that only as of now, NPR only gets about 2% of its revenue from governmental grants that are competitive. And so they've kind of moved away a lot from public funding, but maybe you can tell us kind of some of those challenges and how it ended up kind of going in that direction.
Yeah, well, you know, there's not a great understanding about how public radio gets financed. So you're absolutely right that they get, I think, less than 2% of their funding from the federal government. Almost all of the federal money, which is not a huge amount, and I'm not going to quote a current amount because I'm not exactly sure what that number is today, but any public funding is really distributed among the 300 or so stations. As I mentioned, like Wyoming Public Radio or KCRW in Santa Monica or in Alabama Public Radio or wherever in all 50 states. And it really is very important funding for those smaller to medium stations who may not have the big corporate base, the big philanthropic base, but they provide a very important service in times like this, in providing important news about COVID in your local neighborhood. And as newspapers have fallen upon very, very tough times now, having that local journalism to cover the state capital and cover your local mayor, those resources are drying up as we speak. This is a big tragic outcome of COVID, is going to be the degrading of American local journalism. And public radio remains one of the most important places to get that. And that's why it is super important that we protect it and support it right now. So it's really a consortium, a federation, if you will. And as president of NPR, you're doing two things. You're overseeing that federation. I used to say it's like being the commissioner of baseball, for those of you who are sports fans. And at the same time, you're running this incredibly talented newsroom, which is got some of the most wonderful journalistic talent in the world, who are on All Things Considered and Morning Edition every day and all these other programs and podcasts that they do. So you're balancing out the interests of the whole sport of baseball, and you're also kind of managing the Los Angeles Dodgers at the same time. And it's having this balance of of priority that makes the job quite tricky, but it's a wonderfully important position, and you make a real difference in trying to advocate and drive for this important resource.
So after your time at NPR, you moved on to National Geographic Society as the president and CEO. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what is National Geographic Society, because I think most people, at least our age, probably remember the magazines, the travel magazines that used to come. But
the so National Geographic is 130, it's going to be 132 this year. It was founded in 1888 as really a journal of geography to promote the idea of educating the Americans, mostly at the time and now globally, about the planet and all that's in it. So Alexander Graham Bell was one of the founders, and it was really a bunch of scientists, expedition leaders, and others who were out there discovering the world, so to speak, and bringing it home to you through a journal. And it became a membership society that you could join. Now, this was, way before radio, way before television, even before photography was widely circulated. So first, and it got into all those things along the way. So it was the first major publication to put in photography. It got into television a big way in the 1960s. It had network shows and then cable shows and then created the National Geographic Channels, which is now a joint venture with the Walt Disney Company. Which are around the world in almost 500 million homes around the world. Plus, we continue to publish the magazine. We are the largest social media brand in the world. Our Instagram accounts have 195 million followers, bigger than any other brand in the world. And we have passed two of the three Kardashians. So we're very excited about that. And we're not going to rest until we pass you know who. So we're on it, and I think it shows the interesting range of age demographics that we work in, from little kids who love our animals all the way to older adults who might travel with us. They may, you know, they may buy books, they may, you know, have other engagements with the brand and everything in between. So it's an amazing 132-year-old success story that's been reinvented several times as media has changed. And we think we're, you know, still not reaching our potential, but that's what keeps us hungry and keeps us going.
Yeah, so I think you talked a little bit about Nat Geo as a media platform, Instagram, magazines. It's also a nonprofit, and you guys have missions in science and education. How was that role similar to Sesame Workshop, and how was it different? Obviously, you're not having Kim Kardashian and your Nat Geo Instagram channel collaborating.
Yeah, well, you never know. Maybe we could. Well, this is the Nat Geo is actually two different enterprises with one brand. So we have the not-for-profit society, as you mentioned, which does science exploration. It gives grants. It's created a fantastic program for local journalists to get grant money for doing things in COVID around the world right now. It also does educational work around geography education in schools, primarily for middle schoolers, but lots of materials around climate change, around science, around environment, around pandemics, what have you. So all of those issues. And then the media side is this joint venture, as I mentioned, between the society and the Walt Disney Company, which I oversee now. And that's where the television, digital, and print assets are. So, we are able to really drive media to put out great content like Free Solo, which won the Academy Award a couple years ago for Best Documentary, to a powerful social and digital set of initiatives every single day, and reach lots of people through promoting science and history and wildlife and travel and photography primarily. Those are our sweet spots.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the business challenges you encounter in National Geographic. And it sounds like viewership isn't one of them based off of the Instagram account. So maybe some of the major challenges.
Yeah, I think our viewership is, well, I don't think. Our viewership is up, especially since COVID, both on the linear networks, TV, as well as online. The big challenge now for everyone in these businesses, including in publishing and in television, is a disruption of the whole revenue model for content. And really the web has, you know, taken down and been a great disruptor of, as we mentioned, newspapers. First it was classified advertising that went away. And now it's really taken out a lot of advertising away from print for sure. So we're on the publishing side, we're facing how do we create digital subscriptions, which are more valuable than print subscriptions, because most younger people, as you know, and younger means, you know, pretty much anyone less than a boomer at this point, are not buying as much print or not buying print at all. So it's really about getting someone to put down a subscription or a monthly subscription that may cost as much as a latte or whatever, but it's really subscribing, whether it's Spotify or Netflix or National Geographic, you've got to make something worthy enough that people want to pay for it. So that's really what's going to have to drive publishing in the future and relevant content. And then on the television side, I think we're seeing, you know, now a big disruption with these streaming platforms taking over from the linear cable networks and that bundle that you had to buy from Charter or Comcast or whomever. And now it's really about Hulu, Netflix, Disney Plus, you know, Peacock on, you know, and everything else coming around. And how many of these are you going to subscribe to in your household or want to subscribe to? You're not going to get all of them. Can you be on those that are going to be successful? We certainly think we have a fantastic advantage being with Disney Plus and with Hulu. by primarily Disney Plus, and we couldn't be luckier than being in that very, very important lane on that highway with Disney Plus every day alongside Marvel and Star Wars and Pixar and Disney.
And then kind of mainly, how has your role as a chairman kind of been different than as a CEO now? What are your priorities? What are you looking at?
Well, I'm trying to really do as much as I can in stepping a bit back and looking at these things we just talked about, these trends, so we can be ahead of them and really be thinking out the major issue, which is how can we create great content that is going to reach people. And it's the same lessons we talked about earlier about Sesame Street. You know, you can't teach people unless you reach people. And I have a, you know, it's a very broad definition of teach. Teach also means inspire. It can be, you know, it can entertain, but it does leave you with something more than just junk food for the mind. You know, it's something that National Geographic should be a bit more than simply empty calories. And I think that's what we're trying to do now. So it's allowed me to work with my colleagues like Courtney Monroe and Susan Goldberg and others who really are driving a lot of these content enterprises in brilliant ways, and allowing them the lanes to execute on these strategies that we are working on together.
So you also, in addition to your work with National Geographic, you also serve on the board of the Smithsonian National Museum. So how did that end up happening? And are you a giant history buff?
I am a history buff, but the museum that I'm most that I'm associated with is natural history as opposed to national history. So it's more around the sciences and climate change and ocean and all the rest of that. So one run by a wonderful scientist named Kirk Johnson, and it's an honor to be on that board. It's a, you know, sharing a lot of the same mission and values that I've spent most of my career on. So it's pretty natural. It's just another setting with another fantastic brand called the Smithsonian. And how do we educate the public and kids around these truly important topics that need to be taught in creative ways with the brand association of the Smithsonian? And I think that's where I hopefully am adding some value, and I really enjoyed my tenure there.
And then pre-COVID, it sounded like you liked to travel a lot with your family.
Yes.
Guatemala, Japan, Galapagos Islands. Maybe you can kind of give us a couple of highlights from those trips and recommendations.
Sure. Well, I've, you know, been to every continent. I love to travel. I think, you know, a lot of people talk about traveling, you learn about yourself. And in some ways, I view travel a little differently. I think it gives you an ability to lose yourself and really embrace how people are interacting with this incredible planet we're on in ways that are so different from what your norm is. And they're not necessarily better or worse. They're just totally different. So our way is not the only way. And I think so many issues we get into trouble because we think that this is the only way something can be done. And it just isn't true. I mean, if you go to Japan and ride the trains, you can see what trains could be like. If you ride certain trains in this country, that's not what we're talking about. So I think it's really about having those experiences. And it is just a wonderful thing for everyone to do. There's no better education in the world. And the other thing we talk a lot about at National Geographic is there's a difference between being a tourist and being a traveler. You know, a traveler is someone who's curious, someone who wants to understand the local culture, someone who wants to really eat the local food, as as interesting or maybe gross as it might be to you in looking at, but, and really getting, you know, kind of getting into it as opposed to observing and taking notes like a tourist. And there's a huge difference. And I think those of us in National Geographic represent those people who are curious travelers who want to understand the world. So there's not been many places I really haven't enjoyed visiting.
You're a huge soccer buff. Anything you want to shout out there? And then the final two questions usually are, what is your favorite UCLA memory? And who was your favorite Bruin? And we like to say, I know you were there during the John Wooden times, that he's off limits just because we get that.
Okay. The first question really about soccer is I'm a huge fan and I'm an Arsenal fan. The best thing about COVID is Arsenal is not losing right now. So it's really fabulous, but we will be back. And I've become a big buff for the English Premier League, and it's really a lot of fun. I have so many memories of UCLA, but I think the daily existence of walking into Kirkhoff Hall and sitting down at my little desk and banging out a story about the campus is the thing I'll remember most, because in a big campus, an impersonal campus, one in which it's easy to be forgotten or lost, it was a place where you could demystify the administration and all of these power structures. And it really taught you how to speak truth to power, even if you were a little naive maybe at a certain point in time about certain things. But you got to ask those questions, and where else could you actually be able to inquire with the chancellor or with a US senator or a presidential candidate and have a voice is magnified to 30,000 people back then every day. That is my greatest memory. And what I'm, what I'm always forever thankful for. And in terms of Bruin, are we talking athletics Bruin? Because we're all Bruins.
It could be anyone.
Well, I mean, there's so many. I actually, went online the other day. The list is just ridiculous of how many. I couldn't even believe some of these people. In fact, I've been with some of these people. I didn't know they went to UCLA. So, but, during my era there, the basketball program, I won't mention John Wooden, but, Bill Walton, Big Red, he was so representative of the era that existed. He was a Vietnam War protester. He was someone who was an unbelievable force on the basketball court in his day, fought them to a couple of national championships and almost a third one. I think he couldn't do the fourth one because they used to have a freshman program where you couldn't play on the varsity, believe it or not, as a freshman back then. But Bill Walton was a tremendous leader, and the fact that he was able as kind of a rebel to bond with John Wooden, who was a conservative, very focused, almost spiritual-like leader. It was very much like a, it was kind of like Yoda and or Obi-Wan Kenobi with, in Star Wars, dealing with Luke Skywalker. So it was quite a wonderful thing to observe, and over time it even got better as Bill grew into being the, pretty incredible character he's become later in life. Pretty much favored Bruin.
Thank you so much for joining us on Bruin One Year and Out the Other. Before we let you go, feel free to give us a 30-second plug for something going on in your life or something that's happening with Nat Geo.
National Geographic goes on during COVID, and we're really excited about bringing Instagram Lives to everybody, and I hope you can tune in. We have all of our explorers and scientists and others who are doing incredible things and talking on Instagram, which I think you'll really enjoy as we try to beat two of the three, you know, Kardashians for more Instagram hits. So everybody needs to join us in Common Cause for National Geographic. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again to Gary Now for joining us on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or guest recommendations at bruin1ear@gmail.com. And please make sure to subscribe and leave a 5-star review if you enjoyed learning more about awesome Bruins. And like always, hopefully everything we talked about today didn't go Bruin one ear and out the other.